This is the RightsCast Network at rightscast.net. This is episode 7 of Novel Approaches here on the RightsCast Network. Welcome to the RightsCast Network's Novel Approaches podcast, a craft-focused conversation for writers everywhere.
Because writing novels is hard, and we're all in this together.
Hey there, I'm author, editor, and RightsCast Network founder, R.R. Campbell.
And I'm Sion Ashleman, freelance editor, dog parent to Milton the Adorkable, and your co-host of the Novel Approaches podcast.
In this installment of Novel Approaches, Sion and I will be tackling conflict, what it is, where it comes from, and how we can use it to fuel our stories. But first, Sion, it's good to be back.
Yes, I'm so excited that we decided to make this a regular thing. Geeking out about writing is one of my favorite pastimes. Speaking of which, what's new in your writing life, Ryan?
Well, there's certainly a lot going on. I've got my debut novel, Accounting for It All, is coming out on November 19th, which is very exciting. So there's been a lot of, it's been exciting. So there's a lot of, today, as of the date of this recording, I did a character reveal at accountingforitall.com with some really cool artwork from Maggie Derrick, who also is one of the folks that does the Work in Progress podcast for listeners who might be looking for more writing-related podcasts to listen to, but some really great artwork from her there. I'm working on organizing the book launch party, where I'll have some pizza and drinks available and books and all sorts of fun raffles and things like that. And, you know, there's the whole matter of working on copy edits and proofreading in the lead-up to the book getting actually printed. So, a lot going on, but really grateful for the opportunity and excited for the book to get out in the world. So,
yeah, that's super exciting. I'll have to go check out that artwork. I didn't know you were doing that. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's really neat. The reaction so far today has been very positive. It's got me feeling like, all right, you know, we can get some momentum going here. I'm learning as an author who's on, you know, the cusp of their first book coming out that sometimes it can feel like, is anyone truly going to engage with this story that I have created? But the reaction today to the artwork has been really reassuring and well-deserved, because I think that Maggie did a fantastic job not only, you know, bringing those characters to life, but doing it in a way that I feel very much reflects who the characters that she drew are. So exciting stuff. If folks are interested, accountingforitall.com. That's your place for, that's your one-stop shop for all things Accounting for It All related.
That's awesome.
For sure. So that's kind of what I've got going on. What is what's been going on in your end of the world, Sion, and the writing world, or anything related to editing, writing, what have you?
Man, I've been working on this blog post about your the novel's primary conflict for an obscenely long time. And like for months, it's ridiculous. It's one of those things where I'm having such a hard time writing it because, well, there's a lot of like self-editing going on, but also because I'm trying to talk about this thing discreetly that's actually connected to a whole bunch of other things.
Right, yes.
I'm trying to make it like coherent and understandable, but yeah, but because we're doing this episode, it's really lit a fire under me to get that finished. And that's, that blog post is part of my series on the structure of a novel that I'm planning on turning into an ebook. Cool. Eventually. I'm not sure when that's going to happen at this point.
It's
but
on the horizon.
I'm thinking on it.
Right.
Baby steps.
Is that blog post, you know, not to rush you if it's not, but is that actually posted now?
It will be by the time this airs.
Perfect.
That's cool.
Where will people be able to find that? You may as well give a plug in case people want to follow up after they've listened to the episode.
That is going to be on my website, which is writelearndream.com.
Easy enough to remember. Well, very cool. I'll have to check that out. We'll see how much of our conversation here bleeds into that post. And I'm sure we will find ourselves in that precarious position of trying to keep this conversation limited to conflict. But we do know that, of course, all these things are interdependent, so I'm sure we'll have plenty of other little tips of the hat to other topics as well as we go.
Exactly.
So now that we have exchanged our opening back and forth here, we've talked a bit about what we've got going on in our little corners of the writing world, it is time for The Conversation. I'm imagining that with a little like trademark sign afterward. The Conversation. We're talking about conflict today, of course, but we're going to be specifically exploring what conflict is, why it's important, where conflict has its origin, and how conflict fuels a story. So we may as well start, as we always do on the RightsCast Network, we'll start with definitions. And Sione, I'm curious, let's start with you. How do you define conflict?
It's really interesting because this is one of those things where in preparation for this conversation, actually in preparation for the Twitter chat that we had the other night, I was like, oh, conflict, I know what that is. And then I went to articulate it, and I was like, ugh.
Right.
So I had to look it up in the dictionary.
That's always a place to start. There's no harm in that.
It's like, I know it when I see it, and I can talk about it, but then I couldn't define it. So, just the very simplest definition that I really liked was, it's conflict is opposing forces. And that could be lots of different things. When I think about conflict in relation to fiction, there are a couple different things that come up for me. One of them is the book's primary conflict, which is what that blog post is going to be about or is shaping up. And that is the question or problem that's raised at the beginning of the book and resolved by the end of it. That's the backbone of the book's structure and determines the scope of the book. So that's why the primary conflict is important. And then there are a bunch of other sources of conflict that we'll get into the origins to, and I think in just a minute. But those are important because they create tension and interest, and they pull the reader in and pull them along in the story. Because if you had a story where, Janie wants something, and then she gets it.
Ta-da!
Janie reaches for the orange and grabs it. Like, that's okay, I guess. I don't know. Like, at that point, are we like going into really boring anecdote land? Like, is that actually going to be a story? I do think that you can have. I'm going to go out on a limb and say experimental fiction, you can have story without conflict.
Oh my.
That's a whole other thing. I haven't thought too much about that, but I do think it's possible. But so I'm not going to say that it's absolutely essential to having a story, but it is a major part of, in terms of a novel, I think it's crucial.
Yeah, I really like that you add this bit about how we need to, you're suggesting at the notion of obstacles, it can't be character wants thing, character gets thing. And I couldn't help but think as you were saying that just now of, I think I've got the character name right, but it's Veruca Salt from Willy Wonka. You know, she wants the goose that lays the golden egg. Well, how boring would it have been if she just got the goose that laid the golden egg? I mean, we got to see her. I forget what her doom is. Is she the one that turns into a blueberry? I mean, that's a big part of the story, and we wouldn't have that if she had just gotten what she wanted all the time.
That's Violet Beauregard.
Oh, you're right. Yes.
She's a gum chewer.
Yes.
No, Veruca Salt actually stands on one of the scales.
Oh, and she gets flushed down it.
She's determined to be a bad egg.
Yes.
And is put down the chute, and she's going to be incinerated if she's not rescued.
Oh, my. How dark. How very dark.
Right? Unexamined little, details. Yeah, so, that's kind of like... Maybe that was a little bit rambly, but that's sort of my gist of it. How about you? How do you think about conflict? How do you define it?
So I think you framed it really well. And like you mentioned, when this conversation moves a little bit more into the origins of conflict, I think we'll have a really solid opportunity to sort of expand on what we're getting at with these definitions. I think that when you invoke, the idea that the primary conflict is this central question that is central to the plot, and it's sort of the backbone of our novel's structure. I like to think about it, of course, on that sort of scale, but I feel that for me, when I'm approaching writing a manuscript, as a writer, I look at the scene. If primary conflict is our backbone, the scene, I think, is the nucleus of structure, and I think that I tend to focus very much on conflict within a scene, and then how it kind of grows or escalates or connects to the conflict of other scenes, such that we end up with these longer arcs that form the primary conflict and help us understand what the central question is and how it gets answered. So that's a little bit rambly, so I'll kind of condense it here. I see conflict basically as arising from, and I'm putting this in quotes here, the unresolved. And what I mean by that is we're talking about things like unresolved doubts or feelings or unresolved quests, obstacles that have yet to be overcome, whether foreseen or unforeseen. And I think all of these things can leave a character conflicted and therefore produce conflict on the page. And to kind of add into that, I think that this lack of resolution or this quote-unquote unresolved really requires a sense of direction or a stated purpose for a character or set of characters. And that kind of pulls me into something that I know is going to be a recurring mention of mine both in this episode and surely future episodes as well, which is this notion of goals and goal-oriented storytelling. And of course, we talk about the central question, as you've mentioned here, and I see that as being our character's goal over the long, sweeping arc of a manuscript. But I think it's also really important that in every scene, our character, or all characters in theory, should have goals that are apparent and accessible on the page. And I think that that is where we can get a lot of conflict, is from those goals. And I'll have plenty more to say on goals and the relationship between them across characters and within characters as we get more into origins. So I'll kind of leave it there for now. And the distilled version of all of that is conflict for me comes from the unresolved, and the unresolved comes from a sense of, it comes from a sense of direction that gets its own origins in goal-oriented storytelling. So I hope I made that clear. Was that reasonable? Did I do okay there?
Well, what came up for me, and I think you're starting to touch on it, and I don't want to leap too far ahead, but so when you say the unresolved, and one of the things that you mentioned was like unresolved feelings. And so then what I think about, what I was wondering about in that is, does the conflict come from the character wanting those feelings to be resolved, and then there are obstacles to having them be resolved? Is that kind of what you're getting at, or did I miss it?
I think that that's a pretty fair representation of it. I think that it might be tough to depend overly much on a word like resolved in that case, but that is, of course, how I framed it, and so we'll stick with that for now. I think that the idea of resolution can be framed in a few different ways where storytelling is concerned. So for now, I think that you've represented that well. We'll leave it there, and hopefully there's a chance to explore that a little bit more as we get into origins, and I think it'll become more clear. So for fear of muddling this even further, why don't we turn over now to some folks on Twitter who were part of one of our hashtag RightsCast chats in the lead up to this episode coming out. And I'll start here if you don't mind. We had a tweet from Cinna over on Twitter. He tweets at CINAEDHVIK. For him, he defined conflict as there being one piece of pizza left and two people are eyeing it. Whereas tension, we were trying to tease out the difference between conflict and tension here, he adds that tension is the 4 seconds it takes for one of those people to make a move over those that slice of pizza, basically. So I thought that was a really nice way to put it succinctly and to give us something very tangible to work with.
Yeah, that was a good example, sort of like very concrete example of the difference between conflict and tension. And it sort of dovetails, too, into what A.C. Adams said. They tweet at Child of Nowhere, and they said, conflict is about people on page, the collision between them and others, them and themselves, them and the world, what have you. Tension involves the reader caring about what happens next to the character. It's both a promise of conflict and the result of that promise.
Yeah, that was a really good point. I think that AC has really proven to me that there is a difference between conflict and tension. I kind of went into our conversation today and into that RightsCast chat very much of the mind that, at least for me, it was difficult to tease those things apart. But I think what we see in there is that when you frame conflict such as it's what's happening on the page versus tension is about a relationship between reader and the page, you can really see that there is a bit of daylight in between those two concepts.
Yeah, because I definitely have read conflict without tension on the page before. And I've also read tension without conflict.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And I think on that, I think to your first point, that really stands out to me as something I know that I've read. And that is, I think, conflict where I get the impression that the writer knew that it was important to have conflict on the page. And so characters just get in arguments about things that they're not necessarily advancing our plot or enriching character or standing out as metaphor for the development of character or the advancement of plot. It's kind of like bickering for the sake of bickering, maybe. That's just one example off the cuff that I think is an example of like, yeah, I mean, these people aren't having a very nice time, but where do I as the reader fit into this and where does this take us going forward? I think if we can't answer those questions as readers, we're probably in a situation like you describe where there is conflict on the page, but a real dearth of tension.
And I think what your example gets at is that when you're writing a novel, the conflict has to relate to the story you're telling. Like, you can have two characters arguing over a sandwich, but if it doesn't act as either an aid or an obstacle to the primary conflict, and it doesn't, as you said, reveal anything important to this narrative about their characters, then it's not going to feel like there's not going to be any tension behind it.
Yeah, that's perfectly what I was trying to get at. I think that it's nice to see that, I don't know, we can approach this both as writers and as editors, but approaching it as readers, I think, is equally important when we're considering this topic or any topic, especially if we are writers who are interested in writing fiction that will compel readers to keep turning the page. We really do have to put ourselves in their shoes or like behind their e-reader or, you know, in their hands when they're holding our book to really get a feel for what it's going to be like to read the work that we're putting together.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that we've covered definitions reasonably well. I know that we will have an opportunity here to flesh out some of what we were getting at. So that kind of brings me into this next section, which is talking about the origins of conflict. Sion, I know I'm going to kind of spring this on you real quick here, only because I feel like I've done a lot of talking and I'm always curious to know what you have to say. Why don't we start with you here again and talk about how it is or where it is that you see conflict having its origins, if you'd like to go first.
Sure. Okay. So conflict is in opposing forces. So there are several different places that they can come from. It can come from internal conflict, and I'll get into some details here in a second, interpersonal conflict, or what I'm calling external conflict. Obviously, interpersonal conflict is to an extent external because it involves something external to the character, but just for the sake of categorization, I define those three. And I really think that it all ties back into characters' goals, motives, the stakes, the strategies that they use to try and achieve their goals, and the obstacles that they run up against. So just some examples of like internal obstacle or internal conflicts would be, say they have, two competing values at play in a particular scene. They value obedience but they also value safety, and their parent has told them to stay in the room, but if they stay in the room, the monster is going to eat them. Right?
Yep.
So that's internal conflict, because it's value against value. So you can have two competing goals or two goals that the character has had, and then at some point they sort of have to choose between them. That's internal conflict. like there, I also think that the obstacles, the internal obstacles, create a lot of conflict. Like if the character's flaw or they have like a lack of skill or knowledge, that's going to prevent them from making progress or from triumphing over the conflict. And maybe if the an unexamined worldview can also be a really good internal conflict. Like they're used to seeing the world in this particular way, but actually it's not helping them in this case because what they're encountering doesn't fit into any of the rules they know. And so they have to change the way they see things in order to progress. Did that make sense at all?
Yeah, that makes sense. We're talking about, it's sort of like that, something that we might see pretty commonly at the juncture of a story where a character crosses from the ordinary world into a new world. They're presented with a change that is not necessarily, but is often related to a change in location. And with that can come a great deal of, I think it's fair to call them obstacles, but they don't have to be seen that way. It's just a real life example would be traveling to a new country for the first time. You're in a position where you have to confront unforeseen circumstances. You're navigating different cultural norms that you might not be familiar with or have anticipated. And I think that's similar to what it is that you were speaking to. Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. I've definitely experienced that when I went and lived in Madrid for a while. And then you're getting into like, is there a difference between inner conflict and angst? And I'm not really sure that we want to go down that road, but
right. That feels like we could do a whole nother episode on that.
But yeah. And then, so just a couple examples of interpersonal conflict. If two characters have different goals that are sort of at odds with one another, like one person wants to destroy the university and the other person wants to save it. Or if they have the same goal, but they have different perspectives on the best way to achieve that goal, that's another really good source of interpersonal conflict. So just for those couple of little examples. And then external, I would say, is like character versus world. Like maybe there's a natural disaster, or I'm gonna, again, this sort of ekes into obstacle territory, but my leg fell off and that's gonna prevent me from, or it's gonna present an obstacle to something I'm trying to do. Or there's a predator, like a bear or an alien, or the alien predator,
you know? Alien versus predator sometimes.
Yeah, well, and I guess the reason I'm thinking bear or alien predator as an external as opposed to an interpersonal conflict is because I'm not seeing those as characters that are actually developed. They're more symbolic. Like the alien predator is very one-dimensional,
right,
from my perspective. Like,
yep,
what it wants is to hunt, and that's it.
Right.
And you have to escape.
And sometimes
there's not
you don't
really
need
a whole lot of, like, yeah, there's not a whole lot of nuance, or, you know, there's no reasoning that can happen there, just as there's no reasoning with nature. And so that's why I put it into that bucket.
Yeah, I think that it's fair to talk about, you know, motivation in that way when, and not to digress super far, but since we've touched on it here, you talk about the alien predator. Well, it's fine if the motivation is to hunt. Like, sometimes we're able to roll with antagonizing forces that have these very direct, clear motives, and there's not a lot of room for nuance. In the same way that in, say, the Mad Adam trilogy, which I know is one that you've read, there's in the third book this whole lore about Zeb and the bear and the time that Zeb was with the bear. And we know what we're getting into. Like, the bear doesn't need a motivation. It's a bear. It's coming right for you. Like, watch out. And I think that that is a totally fair way to use conflict and insert it into our stories when it's so called for.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good example, and that's what I was trying to get at there. So, yeah, I would say, you know, obviously there are a lot more sources of conflict, but that gives you some specific examples of those three different kinds that I identify. And as I said, I think those are all connected into the main characters, or, yeah, whether there's one or many, goals, motives, stakes, strategies, and obstacles. So that's that in a nutshell. And how about you? What do you identify as the origins of conflict?
I think that a lot of what I'm going to touch on here is going to be very similar to what you've mentioned, which to me suggests we're hopefully both going down the right track here. I think that your analysis gives us a little bit more granularity than mine might. So we'll see if you agree with that by the time it's done. I think that you're exploring it perhaps in a more nuanced way than I'm trying to approach it, because I am, as I mentioned earlier, grounding this very much in its relationship to goal-oriented storytelling. So what I'm trying to get at when I talk about goal-oriented storytelling and the relationship the conflict has to it is because for conflict to arise from something, I really feel that we need characters with goals that have a sense of direction. And I think that kind of underlies a lot of what you were mentioning, whether we're confronting an antagonizing force that has a motivation that is just, well, I am a bear and I must eat. Our character has to have a goal in relationship to that, and that goal is going to be in that moment, well, I just want to live. I probably don't want to be eaten. So we must have a goal that's on the page, and I think that that is part of where we get that conflict. If our character didn't have a goal and it was just a bear wanted to eat, well, then a bear's going to eat. What are you going to do? We don't have as much conflict there. So I think that, you know, one way to frame this, and you mention it, and I think it's mentioned in one of the RightsCast chat tweets, is there's those classic relationships. It's character versus themselves, character versus another character, character versus like the world or versus nature, etc. And I think that conflict can arise from all of those in very interesting ways, some of which you've spoken to with both internal and external conflict. So the one thing I do want to explore when I'm talking about conflict specifically is that I think some writers can come to the page with this idea that conflict requires a sort of diametric opposition between characters. Like you mentioned in your example, it's actually, I put the same example down. It's one character wants to destroy the universe. The other one wants to save the universe. And yeah, there's tension there. There's tension, there's conflict. It's very clear. But I think that there's room for a lot more nuance than that, as you've spoken to, and I hope that I can do here as well. I think when we're talking about situations where we have conflict arising from these diametric oppositions, is that we have in those moments what I would call conflicting goals, which stands in opposition to what I'll call complementary goals, which is when you have characters who both want to accomplish something similar, but they have different attitudes, beliefs, or values, or as you mentioned, strategies for achieving that goal. This happens, I think, you know, all of the time we see it. One example that I've used in past episodes of the, I believe it was in a RightsCast episode, episode 13 in scene structure, I talked about this a little bit, but Game of Thrones, you know, when the Hound is traveling with Arya, both of them want to get Arya to the twins so that Arya can be with her mother again, but they have very different motivations for doing so. You have the Hound who wants to do this because he wants a ransom to get, you know, in exchange for Arya, and Arya clearly just wants to be with her mom. They have complementary goals. They have the same goal, in fact, but there's conflict between them because they have very different motivations for doing this. And I think that that's an area where there's ample ground to explore conflict and find more nuance in it than I think we see sometimes with the strictly good versus strictly evil diametric opposition conflicting goals approach. I think that this complementary goals, I've mentioned it in the context of Game of Thrones, and I do think that this happens a lot in fantasy, and it's a very useful thing, especially when you have a protagonist who's got their ragtag team of allies and everyone brings something unique to the table. I think that can be really fun and a great way to explore it. But another place that we might see that is things like heist narratives, something like Ocean's 11, or even, I think it's season 4 of Breaking Bad, there's that train heist episode where it's like, we all have a common goal, but there's a lot of conflict because folks are depending on one another and their set of special skills to accomplish a given task that in some cases must necessarily be accomplished before someone else can get to their work. And so we see conflict coming up on an external level throughout the people that have this common goal because they, though they want to trust one another, maybe feel like they can't. Or we have personal previous dynamics that are in play that have evolved over the course of the manuscript, and we can get a lot of really great interpersonal and then inner conflict as well when folks are trying to decide how they want to choose to proceed given that they are presented with a situation that is less than ideal for them and it's something that's been cast upon them from an external force. So I think, again, it comes down to this, everything is related. You know, we can talk about external conflict as like a monolithic thing. We can talk about internal conflict as a monolithic thing, but so often they're very related to one another, and there can be a positive feedback loop where external conflict feeds into a character's internal conflict, and how a character chooses to address their internal conflict manifests itself in such a way that it changes the dimensions or direction of a new or the old external conflict. Holy cow, I've done a lot of talking. Have I lost you and the listeners completely? How are you feeling?
No, I actually am laughing because I totally got all that.
Oh, great. Good. The Red Bull is flowing through me in a positive way today.
Yeah, no, I got all that. And I just want to sneak in there, like, you brought up another example of something that I think is really interesting and important source of conflict is when the conflict arises between people because they annoy the crap out of each other, or because they keep touching on each other's trigger points, which may not have to do directly with the book's primary conflict, but it has to do with their histories, individual histories, even if they haven't met each other before. And so then that presents an obstacle, right? Because their emotions are coming up and presenting an obstacle to making forward progress. And the Ocean's 11 or whatever example that you gave.
Right. And again, I think that what you're adding there, it gets at this idea that we're trying to talk about a topic like conflict as if it exists in a vacuum, but it clearly doesn't, because we're seeing how important characterization is in something like this. We really have to have a solid understanding of not only our main cast, but also our supporting cast, and things like their trigger points and what is their history, because that's a really interesting way to stitch in greater conflict and also enrich character at the same time. So conflict, I think, is more than just, I think it's very fair to approach it from a structural and from a plot standpoint, but it really does so much more for us in the way of characterization, and I think when done really effectively, setting as well. And I mean that even in cases where setting isn't our antagonizing force, like clearly in a novel where there's a hurricane coming and people must prepare, yeah, a big antagonizing force is the setting. But I think there can also be ways in which a character might have a trigger point that is tied into setting in some way, or it could be a person that steps into the room and suddenly the room feels as though it changes, etc. And those are all really great places to bring in new conflict or new dimensions to conflict that might not have existed had we not taken the time to consider the trigger points for our supporting cast as well as our main players.
So
with that in mind, I think that, you know, to sum up kind of what I was saying, as I'm going to say probably about everything, people are going to be sick of hearing me talk about it, but conflict for me really has its origins in goals. And there are a lot of ways to dress that up. I think you explored it really nicely by breaking it down in a little bit more of a nuanced way. But for me, it really comes down to goals and things like scarcity, or sometimes not even scarcity, but just about how we're going to choose to execute our goals at etc., on and on forever and ever. So why don't we, as we did in the last section, turn it over to the folks on Twitter who participated in our RightsCast chat on this topic. I will go ahead and share what Cinna had to say on this one as well. Cinna made a lot of really great points, as he has in many of the RightsCast chats that we've had. But when we asked Cinna and we asked the community what is it that you feel is the origin of conflict, he mentioned that he'd say the origin of conflict is in goals, yay, and goals that are in contention specifically. So it seems like he's getting at this idea of conflicting goals. He refers to his previous tweet about the pizza when he says it's like the last piece of pizza that you can't both have. And he adds that in his work in progress, this kind of conflict arises from multiple political groups with differing views on the future of the city, and there's all sorts of unrest going on. Not everyone can win. And I think that that is hitting really strongly on the idea of conflicting goals, or sometimes maybe having the same goal, but it's that scarcity matter. And that is being brought out really well by him in that tweet.
Yeah, absolutely. And to add to that, so AC Adams, we also have a tweet from them on this question, and they said that that the origins of conflict can come from, anything. Differences in goals, approaches, opinions, methods, philosophies. So they're getting at their, what we were talking about earlier too, that it could come from conflicting or complementary goals or just different strategies, different ways of thinking of achieving those goals. And they go on to say, in my work in progress, I tend to use person versus self and person versus person the most, where in the latter case, there's usually more than two people, and they're usually all also protagonists, which I love, because having that conflict and the resulting tension come from people who you're on everybody's side. I felt that a little bit in the Expanse series. I don't know if you've read any of that.
I haven't.
Or seen the TV show, maybe. Ryan, you gotta get on that.
I know, I'm sorry, you could see me shaking my head in our video chat. It's okay. There's so much media out there to consume, but I believe you've mentioned this in past conversations we've had, so I'll put it on my list. I need some good sci-fi.
Yeah, you're right. There's so much out there. There's so much great stuff out there, but the Expanse is great in that it has multiple points of view, and the multiple points of view, each character, main character, this isn't technically true, but you have points of view that come from different factions, if you will. One from Earth, one from Mars, one from the Belt, one who's sort of more neutral. There are more points of view than that, but that gives you a sense, right? But you come to like them all. They're all protagonists, especially since they end up being united in a goal to, like, save humankind.
Cool, that seems fair.
Yeah, but they have very different ideas about the best way to do that, and are working against each other a lot. So, and I think that's what A.C. Adams is talking about to an extent. And so that's an example of when that's done really well.
Yeah, and I really like those kinds of stories, so that does sound very much up my alley. I think that you sometimes, not everyone is a protagonist, that is a point of view character in Game of Thrones, but I do think that you get that to an extent in that series, and that's also something that I really tried to do and am actively trying to do in the Empathy series as well, because that's multi-perspective storytelling. And I think that though there are certainly characters that are more antagonistic than protagonistic, I've found that with beta readers and other early readers for the manuscript, there's often places where they can identify with everyone to an extent as a protagonist. And I think that that's some really fertile ground to be to be kind of stepped on as writers. And it is an interesting thing to play with, whether it's in a short story or a series or just a single manuscript. And so I'm also really glad that AC brought that up as part of their tweet.
Yeah, and I, just to tag on to that, what you just said makes me really, really excited to do one of these episodes on point of view so that we can dig into some of that in a little more depth, because I really admire what you're talking about for empathy, the way that you can relate even with, the antagonists sometimes become protagonists. George R. R. Martin does that really well in Game of Thrones, where you hate this person for a really long time, and then all of a sudden you like them, and right. You're like, I feel so weird about this, but right. I really like them now. Like Jamie is a character where like hated him and then liked him. Anyway, that's a whole rabbit hole. So getting back on track into this thing on conflict. How do you use conflict to fuel your story? Or I don't even know if I phrased that correctly, but
I know the direction we want to take that here, and I think that conflict fuels a story. And I'm going to kind of riff here. I normally like to have notes in front of me, but I'll call back to a point in my notes that I didn't mention from earlier. I think that conflict fuels story through what I will call action-reaction chains. So if we take, for example, the scene as the nucleus of our story's structure, and if we are also operating under the assumption that within every scene, our protagonist as well as our supporting cast will have goals unto themselves, we will naturally see over the course of a scene, and then over the course of the manuscript as a whole, this action-reaction chain where we have a goal that cannot be met, some obstacle arises, so we go from goal into conflict. there will naturally be some sort of resolution to that conflict, which does not necessarily entail anyone getting what they want. It only means that the obstacle has been resolved or attempted to be addressed. So we have our goal, our conflict, our resolution to the situation. And then we, from there, are naturally pushed into a series of questions, which might include, it should include, I hope, what happens next. And what happens next is a question that can have its grounding in, I think, three different things. One is the classic cliffhanger, however literal we want to look at that. Another is what I'll call a pivot point. A pivot point is something where we can begin to sense as readers that there might be a change in the broader goal. And then there is the third option that I normally see in these cases are change moments. And that is where we as readers begin to suspect or actually witness a change in the character of a character. And that leads us to want to know, what will this growth, or perhaps it's not always growth, but what will this step back for that character push us into as we go forward? And if we reverse all of that really quickly, just imagine the film winding back to what I said at the beginning here, that has its basis in goals, which is what leads us to conflict. And I think that in this way, we have action, reaction, launch into next scene where we've got a reaction to the reaction, which is then our action, and it kind of links together over time. And so long as we have an increase in stakes, so long as stakes are in play, and I'm sure we could do a whole episode on stakes, so we won't go too hard on that now anyway. As long as we have stakes that are continuing to increase over time, I think that we can use the relationship between goals and conflict to fuel the arc of a story in a way that will naturally carry us to a very exhilarating finish, or at least we hope so anyway when we're writing. So that's my quick riff. I hope I didn't go too hard on goal-oriented storytelling, but that's what I was going for.
Well, so then so in the action reaction, because I could, just to be devil's advocate here, mm-hmm. which is my favorite role to play. I could see action reaction happening without any conflict at all.
Right. And yeah, I suppose.
So the conflict comes into play because you're assuming that the action is the source of conflict for either the internal or interpersonal or external. Is that?
Yeah.
Like the action itself
stems from those motivations or the goals, I think, is maybe the basis. That I think that's kind of those are the axioms under which I'd have to operate that entire mini thesis, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you're setting it up so that characters have conflicting goals or, as you said, complementary goals, but they have different ways that they think is the best way to get there, things like that. And so then one character's action creates a reaction in another character that stems from their unique position. Is that right?
Yeah, and I think we can tether it actually really well to the idea of the central question that you mentioned earlier on in the conversation. I think that if we make the assumption that goals are in play, and so long as those goals somehow tie back to our central question, that's where we can get that natural progression of action-reaction, which is going to be different than if, like, our central question is, will our protagonist save the universe? But the goal that the character continues to set is, where am I going to eat my next sandwich? Like, that doesn't really tie... It doesn't really tie into, like, the overall plot, unless there is a way in which eating sandwiches will allow them to save the universe. So I don't know.
Yeah, but I think about, well, that provides an obstacle to saving the universe, right? Mm-hmm. I think about, when you said that, I thought about Barf and Spaceballs, even though that's not his driving motive. He is very food motivated.
Yes.
I bet you could write that story, Ryan. If anybody could write it, you could write it.
Don't challenge me to do it. Oh, God.
I bet you could do it, and it would be hilarious. Okay, back to, there was something else I wanted to ask you. Oh, yeah, I know what it was. So when you map this out, when you map out this chain of action-reaction, do you do it for every single character who was in that scene or who is affected by the action in that scene?
So it depends. I will say that, for example, in Accounting for It All, which is the first novel that I'll have out this November, since that was a single point of view narrative, the manner in which I constructed every scene's structure did rely on that goal, conflict, resolution, you know, cliffhanger, change moment, pivot point structure. I had that in there, but I really only had it for the protagonist because I think I had an understanding of the supporting cast's goals, to me, I didn't feel like I had to map them out because I knew kind of in the back of my head, I had spent a lot of time crafting character in advance of writing, and so I felt like I had enough of an idea of how these characters would respond, which I think is different from the Empathy series, because with that being a multi-perspective, you know, sci-fi thriller, it's, and everyone's trying to like outgame one another in that Game of Thronesian way, I really did have to know, okay, in this scene, Chandra, for example, has a goal that will, you know, conflict for any set of reasons. It will resolve in this way. But that resolution that she finds, whether it's a step forward for her or a step backward, will necessarily have major ramifications for characters who might not have been on the page. So I need to know, what is it that they were doing at this time? At what point would they be privy to the information that is conveyed to readers in this scene? And then how would they react distinctly? And when will we see that reaction from them? So there was a lot more I had to have mapped out, whether that character was even on the page or not. And I wish that I probably could have saved myself years of writing if I had known to map it out for all of those characters in my initial drafts. But, it, you know, 5 years later, here I am. It kind of depends. I think it depends on the nature of the manuscript. I think if you're a writer who can come to the page and you feel like you've got a really innate understanding of these machinations and they work for you, then go for it. But I think that there is definitely some validity in what you're suggesting, which I believe is that it might be worthwhile coming into a scene and asking ourselves these questions, not just about our protagonist, but about our supporting cast as well.
Yeah, well, and it also, I'm guessing it depends on the extent to which the supporting cast is affected by it and what other priorities they have going on in their lives and things like that. But I'm actually, when you're talking about Accounting for It All, it sounds like you did do that, but you did it in your head.
Yeah.
Like, what would, I'm sorry, remind me what the main character's name is.
Her name's Robin.
Robin, yeah. So Robin's bosses, so she's running around trying to figure this whole thing out. I'm guessing that their goals and motives are pretty straightforward, that their personalities are more impulsive than strategic. And that makes a huge difference, too, because in Empathy, I know you have a lot of strategic characters. Or at least maybe more strategic than Robin's bosses might be in Accounting for It All.
Right. Or even just Robin, because I think you're totally right. There's that difference between an impulsive versus a strategic character. Like, Robin is among the more impulsive people. I mean, she tries really hard to think things through, and she's very well-intended, but she doesn't always pick, like, what many would consider to be the most beneficial option when she's presented with two. Sometimes she's very short-sighted, which leads into, you know, it leads her further down this path to additional conflict. I mean, it's kind of her fatal flaw is short-sightedness. And so I think that it really depends on the nature of the character, yeah.
Which leads to awesome fiction, leads to a book
Hopefully.
That I want to read.
Fingers crossed, friends. I hope you enjoy it. November 19th, keep your eyes peeled. But Yeah, that's. I guess those are kind of the approaches that I took to both. You're totally spot on with the assessment of Accounting for All, and that I think I just kind of kept it more in my head because a lot of the goals and motives were more straightforward, and there was less general quote-unquote strategery at play. It was a lot of impulsive people making pretty impulsive choices throughout. So,
yeah.
Yes, but I'm curious now, you know, I've talked a lot here about this particular prompt. I want to know, in your experience as an editor, if you have anything to share along these lines, are there any, you know, common problems that you might see when you grab a manuscript and it comes to conflict? Are there any pitfalls that you see writers tending to fall into when they're working on a longer work of fiction?
Well, you already mentioned one big one,
Oh, cool.
Which is conflict for the sake of conflict.
Okay.
When you have a couple of characters who are arguing, and there is tension on the page, but the source of conflict doesn't have a clear origin in terms of their goals and motives. They seem to be arguing contrary to one another, but it's not clear why they should be doing that, given what we know about these characters, where they're coming from, what they want, that kind of thing. So I'd say that's one that I've seen pretty often in the last year, is because the author knows that there needs to be conflict in each scene, there needs to be tension, so they have their characters in the scene have an argument about something, but it doesn't seem to be in keeping with their character, or B, like we talked about earlier, maybe they're arguing over a sandwich and that has zero to do with the primary conflict, and so it just feels extraneous and like a floppy side, tentacle rather than that. I don't know if that analogy even works, but that's what came to mind. It's a floppy side tentacle as the main body.
I'll say this too, because I totally agree with what you're saying, and I can think of, and I don't know, maybe I'm playing devil's advocate here, maybe not. I just kind of want to make sure that there's an angle that we can, take forward for writers who might find this beneficial, like the sandwich argument. I think that there are ways that you can, and this can be tricky to pull off, but you can have the sandwich like stand in for like a conflict that's not really about the sandwich. It's, in couples, for example, if they get into fights about like what color they're gonna paint a wall, or they're buying a home and they can't pick between one or the other because they each have their own preferences, and rather than talk about that actual thing, they get in a weird fight about I don't know, when the dog needs to get taken out, or I don't know, it's little things like that. I think that there can be stand-in arguments that can be sometimes even strictly symbolic that we can bring forward. But that's, again, I think that's a different dimension entirely that I think I would encourage writers to play with. But unless you're super clear on your intention to use it that way, it can sometimes come up short.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great point. There are ways to make that sandwich argument relevant to the primary conflict, and so yeah, I want that to be clear. But what I have seen are the equivalent of sandwich arguments that are not relevant to the primary conflict,
Right.
or arguments that are relevant to the primary conflict, but don't feel in keeping with who those characters have been up until that moment.
And that kind of plays in too to this notion of characterization being an important part of conflict as well. Because if we already have a consistent feel for character and then folks are literally out of character, where does that leave us when we're talking about this multidimensional approach to storytelling?
Character is everything.
Right. Yes. We lose all sense of grounding in our world in character.
Yeah. So, okay, so that's one. And the other one I wanted to talk about that I've seen pretty often is when the, and it's more like a big picture thing, it's about the book's primary conflict. When the book's primary conflict is left unresolved. And I've seen this happen for a couple different reasons. One of the reasons is because it's the first book in a series, and the series conflict is introduced, but there's no primary conflict of this particular book
Right.
that ends up being resolved in this book. I feel very strongly that when you go to write a book, if you're gonna say this is a book, a complete book, maybe not the whole series, but a complete book, you need to have some problem that's raised in the beginning and resolved in the end. Even if it's just like, you're thinking of it as like the first mission in a series of
Yes.
missions that make up this whole series conflict, or even if it's like this battle has an outcome, but the war is still going on, right? I'd love to come up with a non-warlike
I'll
analogy
give an
for that.
example actually, because this kind of plays in really nice. I totally agree. I've actually seen that in manuscripts that I've edited as well. And so what I have tried to do in my own writing to avoid this pitfall is to invoke this idea of the action reaction chain again. So you have book one, where, for example, in the Empathy series, and this isn't, these aren't going to be real spoilers, because, I mean, it's the central question. It's posed at the start of the book. But the in the first book, the real question is, well, how will this study into the first round of human trials for an internet access brain implant, how is this going to be resolved? Is it going to be a net positive or a net negative for our characters and for humanity? And then in the second book, we don't like have that arc. I mean, that arc kind of lingers over the course of the whole series, but we do get some kind of resolution by the end of the first book. And then the second book, by and large, I'd say the overworld plot, the central question pertains to what will the results of an investigation tell us? You know, so there's this relatability, but we are seeing an advancement from this action, this series of actions taken in book one, to how are all of our characters going to deal with, what is their reaction going to be to book one, and what will that create for us in this book, that it has its own independent arc that is still related to the arc of the first book.
Yeah, I don't, I'm going to bring up an example that maybe not everybody's seen, but I just binge watched the first season and episode of season two of Broadchurch.
No, not familiar.
It's a David Tennant murder mystery in rural England, on the coast, coastal town in England. The primary conflict of the first season, so it's one of those where the murder is committed in the first episode of the first season, and it takes the entire season to find out who the murderer is and catch them. And so the question or the problem that's presented in the beginning is who killed this boy and why, and then obviously wanting to bring that person to justice. And in the end of season one, they have caught the person. I'm not going to do any spoilers.
Right.
they have caught the person, and that person has is going to jail. And then now I'm like, can I do this without a spoiler? Then the first episode in season two is about still trying to bring that person to justice, and something unexpected happens that kicks off a new problem.
Right.
That's going to last for the entirety of season two, one assumes.
But with that in mind,
or should we just edit that out?
No, I think there's validity in this. I think it's kind of bleeding over into a possible future episode where we talk about writing a series, because there is a lot. There's so much that can be explored in this area. But I think that to put a little bow on this, as I know I've used that before, but the idea is that we do have a question that's being posed in our manuscript. By the time that manuscript is done, whether we're writing a series or not, we must have in some way answered that question. To leave that central question unanswered is like a, I think a lot of people think that's a cliffhanger, but it's less of a cliffhanger and more of a, as a reader, I would say, and I'm trying to step away from approaching this as a writer and editor, but I would just say as a reader, that leaves me feeling very unsatisfied. And it's not necessarily a cliffhanger that makes me want to read on. It is in some ways a betrayal of trust between reader and author, and that I don't feel as though I'm getting what I was promised as a reader, and therefore I don't know if I will continue with book two.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. That and for the series part, like, you can have a complete narrative arc. You can have a resolution to the primary conflict of book one and still have unresolved threads.
Yes.
That's the reader into book two. And that's the goal. It's not to leave the primary conflict unresolved so that they have to buy book two, because that just pisses people off, frankly.
For sure, yes.
Yeah. So the other reason that the primary conflict gets unresolved is because it remains unresolved. And this is, I'm going to think about like a standalone now instead of a series, is because there are multiple plots going on. Most common example is you have an external conflict and you also have a like a romance subplot.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
And in the interest of developing the romance subplot, what would have been the primary conflict kind of peters out and takes a back seat. And then the resolution actually of the book answers a completely different question than the one that was raised in the beginning.
Oh, sure,
yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely, it does, yes.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be a romance subplot. That's just the one that I've seen that acts, it's most distracting to people because they really want to do it justice, and that makes sense to me. But yeah, so when you ask a question in the beginning and you answer a different question in the end and you don't have a really clear turning point that sets people up for that shift, that's when it can stay unresolved. And that's also something I would avoid.
Right. I think that there is overall, I mean, between both your comments there, kind of what we were talking about in terms of writing a series versus writing something self-contained, and even going back into my long winding explanation of it all coming back again to goal-oriented storytelling, there's a lot of fodder here for writers to take with them.
And that's why I was excited about your idea of hosting chats in advance of recording episodes so that we could get some other perspectives. And so on that note, I know that you have some listener comments that you pulled out from our Twitter chat that we did a few days ago on how conflict fuels story. What have you got on that?
We've got three comments here. I've read a lot of comments from Cinna, so I'm actually going to start with an individual who we have not mentioned on this podcast yet, but that is KJ Alexander. KJ tweets at KJ Alexander Inc. The question that we posed here was similar to what it is that we were just discussing, which is how does conflict fuel story? KJ mentions that I use discomfort. For every scene, my characters must deal with difficult surroundings, circumstances, people, or all of the above, which I thought was nice because of all the perspective that we saw in that RightsCast chat. Surroundings didn't come into play a lot, which I think kind of harkens back to something I mentioned briefly earlier, which is that idea that setting can be a really big driver of conflict. And I think it's important that not be overlooked when we're considering or looking for ways to bring new dimensions of conflict to our page.
Yeah, absolutely. And the way that KJ framed that makes me think too, not just like of survival tales, where the character's goal is to survive and the setting is making that difficult. But it could also be that the character's personal history, again, that the setting actually acts as a character that triggers the main character in the same way that an interpersonal conflict might when two characters get on each other's nerves. But if there's something about the setting itself that makes the could, you know, it could be a classroom or a windowless cell, kind of the same thing. But but yeah, it could be something like that triggers something in the character that then their emotions act as that obstacle, and so that's the starting point of that conflict.
Yeah, certainly. So that was what KJ had to say. We've got two other tweets here. Would you like to pick one and roll with it?
Sure, I'll read Sinna's. He was saying something similar to what you mentioned earlier, Ryan, that the internal drives the external, and the external modifies the internal. And I really like that, the way that he was thinking about it and the way that you were talking about it earlier, that it's not just internal conflict as separate from external conflict or interpersonal conflict, but that they actually feed off of each other.
Yeah, it's a really important dynamic to explore because it can be, I think, in any of these conversations, super easy to think about everything as being sort of in its own little bubble, but it really is sort of, I like to think of it as a clockwork, you know? It's like opening up an old school clock and you see all the gears in there. They all have an effect on one another, even if they're turning independently or so it would seem. One kind of cranks the next, which pulls a lever, and it's a whole thing. So I think that was a really important observation, and I'm glad that Cinna had to, he was able to throw that in there, because I was grateful to see that for sure.
What's the name of that kind of art installation where you set the ball rolling and then it crashes into a thing which pushes over the thing which
it's, I believe it is called a Rube Goldberg machine.
Yes,
Yes.
Rube Goldberg. Yeah.
I was actually, I was combing my brain for that as I was talking about it, and it wasn't until you asked the question where I was like, aha, yes, which I should have remembered. I actually have a character in the Empathy universe who has, like, Rube Goldberg machines as a hobby, and I could never for the life of me remember it, but, you know, here we are, so.
Yeah. There's also a really good OK Go music video using Rube Goldberg machine.
Yeah, that's actually, great. Now that you mention it, I remember seeing that. I think that's an older older video of theirs relative to their career, but I have a faint memory of seeing that. Yeah.
Yeah. So if anybody wants a visual sort of representation of the kind of chain of events that we've been talking about, that's a really good example.
There it is.
I'll find the link, and we can put the link in the description.
All right. We're making a mental note now to put that at rightscast.net/resources for this episode's resources. We'll do our best to make sure we put that in there. So we've had a lot of opportunity to talk about prompts that I know that we brought to the table. There is a listener question that was pitched at us during the RightsCast chat. This one came from KJ Alexander. I was really glad that this one was brought to our attention, and we probably don't have to go too in-depth on this one, but I think it is one that's worth addressing. And the question we received here was, can the main external conflict, so our central question basically, can that ever be put on hold within a story, and for how long? Nice little pause here as we consider this. Do you have any thoughts on that off the cuff at all?
I would say that that if it is put on hold, meaning nothing in the scene is either ends up being an aid or an obstacle to the primary conflict, then that would be experimental fiction. That's what I would say. That's my off the cuff response. What about you?
So I think that's a good answer, actually. I hadn't thought about it in those terms. I was kind of thinking of it as I was thinking of it as making a distinction between our main plot and a subplot, though in theory our subplot should in quotation marks, but that should tie in somehow to our main plot, and that it has an effect on our character's internal struggle or a different external conflict, such that it all kind of comes back to answer that central question in the end. So I think maybe in that regard, we're not truly stepping away from the central conflict. We are maybe taking it. It's like being at the optometrist and you're getting your eyes checked. Like, you're staring at this chart and you know that the end goal is to figure out what your prescription is. But along the way, the letters are going to come in and out of focus, but they're always there. Like, maybe that's a quick metaphor to describe it. It's like we still need those letters to be there if we're to answer this question at the end, but there can be times where it's like slightly fuzzy as we try and figure out what it is we're going to do to get our way to that prescription at the end. My God, I hope that made sense.
Yes, I do. That made sense. Yeah, and very, very creative analogy too. Meanwhile, over here, my little hamster wheel was turning, and I was thinking about, you know what a really good example of a book that a lot of people have read that seems to do this, seems to put the primary conflict on hold for, like, repeatedly? Pride and Prejudice.
Oh, all right. I know this is your jam, so I'm going to let you run with this one.
This is my jam because P&P! because for huge chunks of the book, I mean, basically, like, Lizzie is trying, and not very hard, to, like, she doesn't even really have to try. She's just going about her business. Because at this point, like, Darcy and Bingley have scarpered off to London, where she is not, and she's going to visit Charlotte in where she's living with Mr. Collins. If you have no idea what I'm talking about, and if you've never read this book, at least go read the Cliff Notes.
It's an important one to have some grounding in. It is an important one to have some grounding in.
Or see the movie, because the movie is really good. The 6-hour-long BBC miniseries is excellent. Anyway, and so she like, it seems like Bingley and Darcy have gone away forever, as they say in the narration. And so she's going to go visit Charlotte and Mr. Collins. Well, she has no idea that Lady Catherine de Bourgh, or maybe she does at that point, but we're not expecting her to run into Mr. Darcy while she's visiting. But she does. So even though it seems like the conflict is being put on hold, it actually she ends up stepping right back into it. And it's the same when she goes on the tour of the lakes with her aunt and uncle. That's another example. It seems like she's totally avoiding this whole Darcy thing, but then she runs into him again. So it's so great. And this keeps happening over and over. And the whole thing with Lydia and Wickham, that seems to be a completely unrelated subplot until you realize that it's at the end, that it's only because Lydia and Wickham eloped. And yeah, you're getting spoilers for this one. I'm sorry. This book has been out for centuries.
Right. I think it's okay to share spoilers.
It's only when you realize that because Lydia and Wickham eloped, Darcy had a way to prove himself that he's changed, and Lizzie ends up getting together with him. And so there are all of these little moments in that book where it seems like, okay, this has nothing to do with Lizzie getting together with Darcy, but it keeps coming back to it and keeps coming back to it and keeps coming back to it.
So I think then, if we're to distill both what it is that you've mentioned here and kind of my take on it, our answer anyway seems like it would be the only time you're ever true, if you're in a position where you're truly stepping away from that external or from the primary conflict, you're truly stepping away from the central question, it's likely experimental fiction and not what we would consider classic genre fiction, because in many ways, those subplots, and I actually, as I'm looking at this thread on Twitter again, I see that Cinna, who is now going to be world famous after his inclusion in this episode so many times, he mentions something like this when he's responding to KJ's question. He says that, in his opinion, you can step away from that main external conflict so long as the subplot's capturing the attention of the reader, but he adds that the subplot should tie into the main plot. And at that point, it's like, well, are we really stepping away or not? And I think that's maybe what could be up for debate in readers' minds as they, in, excuse me, in listeners' minds as they make up their own mind about the answer to this. So I don't know. I feel like we're on the same page here, but it seems like there's some room for pondering on it and framing it in a way that makes sense to every individual writer, I guess.
Yeah.
So, well, very good. We've covered a lot here today. I think it's probably fair to start wrapping this one up. We'll bring it to a close here. I want to mention to the listener world, to the listener universe, this is a podcast series that we are going to be doing every month going forward. I know that Sion and I are both in agreement that we want this to be a podcast that is as much about the writing community as a whole as it is about the topics we want to choose. So with that in mind, we're going to continue to host WritesCast chats in the lead up to our new episodes. We want to get your feedback on the topics that we cover, and we also want to put you as listeners in control to an extent of the content that we cover. So with that in mind, keep your eyes on Twitter at the WritesCast Twitter handle, which is just WritesCast. After this episode debuts, we're going to put up a poll. It'll be up for a week. We're going to give some options for what it is you might like us to explore in the next episode of the show, which will debut in November. We're thinking that the poll for the next section, excuse me, we're thinking that the poll for the next session, for the next episode, we're going to be offering up the following topics for you to choose from, and that is chapter breaks, point of view, including multiple points of view, or goal-oriented storytelling. That's my favorite, of course. And then we'll also have an option for other. So if you have comments and you want to get some topics thrown into our broad pool of what we might cover going forward, of course, comment on the poll. Let us know what that is. And if it gets our interest churning a little bit, maybe we'll take that and run with it as our next topic. But again, hang out on WritesCast at Twitter. That's at WritesCast on Twitter, I should say. And yeah, have your say in what it is that we tackle going forward. We'd really love to hear from you, as of course we'd like to share your perspective in these episodes as well. So I think to wrap it up, thank you for joining us for this episode of Novel Approaches here on the WritesCast Network.
Yes, thank you. For more content like this, head over to WritesCast.net or follow us on Twitter at WritesCast. I'm also on Twitter at WriteLearnDream. I'd love to connect with you and hear what you're working on.
And I am over on Twitter as IamRRCampbell, and I think we had a little fuzziness when the website was given out before, so I'll reiterate it here, it's WritesCast.net. And then, of course, before we say goodbye, I want to thank the RightsCast Network's patrons at patreon.com/RightsCast. Patrons of our programming get access to all sorts of writerly perks, including stickers, votes in the annual RightsCast Awards, and at the higher levels of support, partial manuscript critiques.
We'd especially like to thank Kristen Oakley, whose contributions at the Wise Mentor level get her shout-outs in every RightsCast Network episode, on top of all the other great patron awards she receives.
That is correct. So if you want to learn more or become a patron yourself, you can visit patreon.com/RightsCast. That is patreon.com/RightsCast. And next up on the RightsCast Network, we will have an R.R. Campbell RightsCast episode, which will debut on October 19th. This will feature creativity coach and the owner of Odonata Creative, Sarah Sadie. That episode will be on overcoming one's inner critic and writer's block, and like I mentioned, that will be out on October 19th, so stay tuned for that.
That's it for this episode of Novel Approaches. Thank you for listening.
Until next time, you know what to do. Write on and write well. This is the RightsCast Network at rightscast.net.